Good morning. Boy, when you hear that music, it just really makes you think about the first time you saw that scrolling up your screen. It's 10:06, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. May 25th, 1977, the cultural phenomenon known as Star Wars suddenly appeared on movie screens all across the country. And now, 35 years and six episodes later, we're still talking about how this motion picture and its sequels and prequels changed the way movies are made, marketed, and talked about. Lines from the films have become part of our conversational language. Today we're going to talk about Star Wars, the universe created for us so vividly by George Lucas. And here's where you come in. You remember seeing it in the theater for the first time? What did you think? How did it affect you? Join the conversation at 800-486-8655. Send an email to talk@WPR.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. I have two guests this hour. First, let me introduce Ethan Gilsdorf, author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, An Epic Quest for Reality Among Role Players, Online Gamers, and Other Dwellers of Imaginary Realms. Good morning and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Hi. Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
Also joining me this morning is Tony Pacitti, who is author of My Best Friend is a Wookiee, One Boy's Journey to Find His Place in the Galaxy. Good morning to you, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the question I put to the audience, and I'm sure we're going to get a ton of calls this hour about this. But I want to hear each of you talk to me about your experience and what you thought the first time that you saw Star Wars. And Ethan, let's start with you.
Well, I'm lucky to be old enough to have seen it in the theater. when it first came out in 1977, I was 11 years old. And, you know, like so many people who talk about this movie and their first experience seeing it, I was just completely mesmerized. And it has a special power on young boys in America, I think. And I just came out of that movie just feeling inspired, feeling energized, you know, feeling like I really could go out there and, you know, be Luke Skywalker myself. It made me want to be a filmmaker. It made me want to be a storyteller. It made me want to do what Luke did.
Mm-hmm. And Tony, what about you? Where did you see it first, and how did it affect you?
Well, my first instance was at home on video. And actually, I saw The Empire Strikes Back before I saw the original Star Wars. And it happened on a kind of a rough day. I was 8. I had just moved to a new town recently, and I had been attacked by the older guys in the neighborhood with mud balls and rocks. So I kind of went home with my tail between my legs, and my mom decided to put The Empire Strikes Back on, which of the Star Wars movies is really the dark, depressing one. But at the end of it, I'm like, oh, well, the good guy lost, and he found out that his dad is the most evil guy in the universe, but he still picked himself up and, you know, decided to fight another day. So I guess things aren't all that bad. That sort of, it was inspiring that after all this rough conflict that these heroes had gone through, that they still managed to, you know, look hopefully towards one more fight. So that was what I took away from it first.
Well,
time.
So you saw that one first, and then did you say, hey, you know, I want to see the original, or how long did you see the first one?
It wasn't too long after that. It was shortly after that that I got the trilogy as a gift from my parents, and, you know, wore the tapes out. I pop them in now, and they're all snowy and staticky just from how much I watched them as a kid.
I know whereof you speak. why do you think this movie affected you so? And both of you, what was it about this series of films, whichever one you saw first? Why do you think it affected you the way it did? And Ethan, we'll start with you again.
Well, I think it's important to remember, you know, historically that the 1970s, you know, particularly for me as a kid growing up in a small town in America, this is before the internet, you know, this is before digital special effects, and it was a sort of a dark time in our country. And I think, you know, if you read some of the stories about George Lucas making the movie, he really talked about, you know, wanting to get past the age of Vietnam and sort of these darker movies like Taxi Driver and Deer Hunter and all these movies that were coming out in the 70s to just produce a movie that was fun to watch. It was a real throwback to those swashbuckling space opera movies where there were heroes and heroics and, you know, something that was quite actually, I think, old-fashioned. And he was just very smart. He was just very smart and just figured this was the time, I think, in our culture where we were ready for this kind of escapist adventure film where, you know, where we are introduced to a whole world in the same way that I think Lord of the Rings and Tolkien captivated a generation of people in the 60s. This was such a detailed, what's the right word I'm looking for? You know, detailed and incredibly rich universe that Lucas had created, even though he borrowed a lot of the motifs from, you know, from eons of storytelling across all cultures. You know, he really tapped into this kind of universal, what Joseph Campbell would call like the monomyth, you know, sort of the hero who has a space, maybe special powers or a secret background, who's orphaned and, you know, comes into his own and gets to go on this amazing quest and this amazing adventure and leave his humdrum town behind. I was a little kid living in a small town in New Hampshire where there was nothing going on. So isn't that everyone's dream, you know, to go off on some adventure? And to take part in events that are bigger than oneself, and to change the course of, you know, of events in this planet or this galaxy or another galaxy. I'm sure, Tony, you have some things to add to that. But for me, that was something that just really was, I thought, a pretty novel, thing to reintroduce into the American cultural conversation.
Well, Tony, your experience with the Neighborhood Boys clearly colored your reception of the message of Star Wars. Why else do you think this movie affected you the way it did?
Well, I mean, you know, to sort of follow up on what Ethan was saying, you know, watching it now, I always kind of imagine Luke Skywalker on the cover of Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, just like a small-town kid who just wanted to get out, wanted to see the world out there, and the characters were all just so real. You know, things like Star Trek, where the sci-fi was very, you know, clean, and they were all soldiers and officers, and it was entertaining, but it was very much science fiction. What Star Wars did is really grounded these characters in conflicts that were easy to relate to, like Luke wanting to, you know, leave the farm behind and see the rest of the world, or, you know, Han was a hero who was so, you know, morally kind of gray for the first movie. So just watching these real characters with real problems exist in this fantastic world, and going along with what Ethan said about the world being so realized, it felt lived in, which is something that really struck me. Is, again, going back to Star Trek, everything was very clean and perfect, but Star Wars wasn't perfect. You know, their ships were banged up, and they looked like they were old hot rods, and everything about it, you could almost feel the scenery breathing and actually coming to life, which struck me as a kid. It really, you know, set my imagination off, and I just really wanted to explore that world as much as I wanted to explore my own.
We have some callers who want to join us. Let's start taking calls right now, because I know that the lines are probably going to be full most of the hour. Let's go first to Milwaukee. We'll hear what Mike has to say. Mike, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi, and thanks for taking my call. I'll make two quick responses, questions, and then I'll take any responses off the air. I can barely hear you. Could you discuss Star Wars as a remake of Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress, a samurai movie? And I was also wondering, could you also discuss Star Wars' original Hollywood incarnation as a B-movie undercard to the now all-but-forgotten post-nuclear apocalyptic film Damnation at Alley, starring George Papard, which was intended to be the top bill of the double figure feature. Thank you. I'll take any response off here.
Who wants to take this one first?
I've heard that Lucas was inspired by Kurosawa. I don't know that film, unfortunately, The Hidden Fortress. So I can't really speak to how similar the plot lines are. As for the second question, I just don't know. I don't know anything about that in particular. I don't know, Tony, if you have any insight into that.
Yeah, not with the second one. I'm not familiar with that, but you know, Hidden Fortress, you know, just growing up reading about Star Wars and what Lucas's influence were, you know, Kurosawa and specifically Hidden Fortress kept coming up, and I did see it somewhat recently, the idea of you know, an old general taking a princess sort of across enemy lines, you know, or sort of the same idea with like Obi-Wan trying to get R2 and the princess to the rebels. But I think what really Lucas took away from it was there were these two peasant characters in Hidden Fortress who are just these kind of bickering comic relief guys, and they're sort of caught in the middle of this bigger conflict that they really have no interest or stake in. And he said that C-3PO and R2-D2 were really based around that, and that essentially one way to look at this series was that it's this wide sweeping saga through the perspective of these two droids who, well, more recently they seem to have more of an important role in it, but that was sort of his idea, these two minor characters who you're sort of experiencing this greater conflict through. I think that's my understanding of what he took away from Hidden Fortress.
And I think what's interesting is, like you're saying, Tony, for those of you who remember how the first Star Wars film opened, for a good 10 or 15 minutes, there's virtually no humans involved and no dialogue direct. You don't really get a sense of who the main characters are, and all of it is done, you know, through the point of view of these two robots. And the movie initially seems to be more about the robots than anything else, and then you realize, you know, they're on the planet, they get ejected from the spaceship ship onto Tatooine, and then that's how we meet Luke, is sort of through the adventures of the robots, which is really a very clever technique. And it sounds like, you know, Lucas had read up on his film history and borrowed that one from Kurosawa.
Yeah.
Well, he also talks about, he's been interviewed hundreds and hundreds of times about these movies, but he also talks about his love growing up of the Saturday afternoon cowboy serials, and episode 241 of Hopalong Cassidy or whatever, that sense of adventure and where there were, you know, heroes and villains and people you could really cheer for, and look forward to a happy resolution of the conflict created in the film, and that's clearly, I mean, that's in just about every episode. I mean, the second of the first three movies is a little darker because we have we really see the Empire clamping down. But then the third episode, this triumphant thing, it really finished that off on a high note. It really, you know, really pushed that theme. But he really was fond of those Saturday afternoon westerns.
And I think what's interesting about his point of view. Sorry, Tony, you want to go first? Or?
No, go for it.
Just that, you know, a lot of people argue, you know, is this really science fiction or is it really just fantasy or, you know, romantic fantasy space opera? But, you know, one of the themes that we see in see in science fiction movies all the time is this sort of fear of technology. And what's sort of wonderful about what Lucas is doing here is he's sort of suggesting that, you know, you can create these Death Stars and these, you know, enormous technological doomsday machines and so on and so forth. But, you know, there's a way to defeat them. In the third Star Wars movie, these, you know, primitive Ewok teddy bear like creatures somehow manage, somewhat implausibly, to defeat, you know, the Empire with, you know, with basically sticks and rocks, with the kinds of things that those neighborhood bullies attacked you with.
Yeah,
Tony,
exactly.
They weren't small furry creatures by any chance, were they?
No, they were not.
Okay. But science fiction depends on the willing suspension of disbelief. I mean, we have to buy into the concept that Lucas is selling, and I think as a population, we certainly did.
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and I want to ask you why. Tony, why don't you go first? Why did we buy it? I mean, because, you know, that wasn't the only implausible thing that we saw. But why did we buy into George Lucas's vision of the universe and how technology worked inside it?
Well, you know, I mentioned before the characters, and I think that's really, you know, before you can accept any truths that he's trying to establish about his world, you need to buy the people that live in it. You need to care. And I think that's what really, you know, dragged people in. And then as far as the technology, it's not like, you know, Star Trek, a lot of that stuff sort of, imagined a cell phone before it actually happened. And all these real-world technologies, Star Wars was just fun to look at. It was truly fantastical, and things that we had never seen before, you know, swords that were made out of light and spaceships that looked, you know, didn't look like the rockets we were sending people to the moon with. They were just these really cool, bizarre, you know, the Millennium Falcon was supposedly designed after a hamburger with a bite taken out of it and an olive sticking out of the side. It was also bizarre and weird and different that it was so captivating that we couldn't not just let ourselves tumble into this world.
Ethan, you want
to follow up on that? To sort of build on what you were saying earlier, Tony, this idea that it was a lived-in world, it wasn't this sort of pristine, perfectly white and clean and squeaky clean, you know, universe. The Millennium Falcon, you know, didn't go into hyperdrive half the time. You had to bang on it.
Yeah.
It was always things are falling apart. You know, things were scuffed up and dirty. You know, the desert planet was just sort of, you know, constantly, you know, things are falling apart. There was a sense of it. People really had built, like, there was a sense that these were actually built. And of course,
right.
As someone who has seen, you know, both of us have seen the technology of special effects change, when you look at some of the early, you know, behind-the-scenes making of movies, you realize to build this movie, they had to do it. I mean, it was a real DIY kind of endeavor. You know, they had to, like, find model airplanes and plastic parts and glue them together and, you know, hang things on wires. And, I mean, it was just the beginnings of computer-controlled photography, but other than that, it was very old-fashioned. A lot of the landscapes are matte paintings done with, you know, oil paint on pieces of glass. You know, very very old school.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have some more calls. Lines are available if you want to get in now with a question or a comment. I want to hear about your experience with the Star Wars franchise. Where did you come in on this? Were you somebody? I was in my 30s when I saw the very first movie in the theater. I just loved it, and I liked most of the movies since then. But I want to know what your experience was of these films. How did they affect you? What did you think when you saw it for the first time? And how did you respond to subsequent episodes? What did you think about George Lucas's vision of the universe and our place in it? And the other thing I want to talk about this hour, and we'll get to that after the break a little bit, is some of the more spiritual aspects of Star Wars, this whole idea of the Force. I'm wondering if the attention that got paid to that was a surprise to Lucas or not, and we'll have our guests respond. But I'd like to hear from you. Here's how you get in touch. Phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, email address talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook and leave a comment or a question there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Take these two over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up for dinner.
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done. Now, come on, get to it.
It's 10:26. Well, that ominous theme music generally presaged the arrival of Darth Vader, one of the arch-villains. We can't forget the Emperor. But that music by John Williams, clearly a huge part of the success of Star Wars. His film scores for those movies were a major part of, I think, how people enjoyed it. It really showed how music can enhance a film. We're talking about Star Wars. Last Friday was the 35th anniversary of its theatrical release. I have two guests on the phone with me this morning. Tony Pacitti, author of My Best Friend is a Wookiee, One Boy's Journey to Find His Place in the Galaxy, and Ethan Gilsdorf, author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, an epic quest for reality among role players, online gamers, and other dwellers of imaginary realms. The phone lines are filling up even as we speak. Still one line available for you if you call right now at 800-486-8655. Before we go back to the phones, let's talk a little bit about the Force, because that became actually somewhat controversial in some religious circles. There were accusations that George Lucas was preaching some sort of heretical religion and trying to insinuate that into the culture, and that there were all sorts of subtexts for this. How did that come about? I mean, what did you think of some of those arguments, and what about the Force as something, as part of the films, and its whole, this was woven into all of the Star Wars movies, of course, because it's almost like a character of itself. And Tony, why don't you go first on this one?
Sure. By the time I was 8 when I saw Star Wars for the first time, which was in the early 90s, in 92, so it was all sort of really established at that point. I think the arguments that the Force was some sort of subversive pagan influence from George Lucas or whatever wasn't really there. But for me, it turned the Force into something. In the first one, you don't really know much about it. Obi-Wan talked about how it gives a Jedi his power, but he doesn't really go much into the detail of it. But when Yoda comes around, he teaches it. It's not a superpower. It's not just a weapon. It's more than that. Machines aren't what's important. It's what's around us. And it was a very mystical, more fantasy sort of take on, what people had expected from science fiction. And it was very, almost, I want to say, humbling. I guess you sort of see Luke fight to understand it, and his everything he's known is sort of being, he's fighting against what Yoda's trying to teach him. And it's very counterintuitive to just, point gun, shoot bad guy. It was almost too philosophical for me as a kid. Not that it was, I just didn't really, it was cool. Yoda was a cool character. And as I got older, I began to really appreciate that sort of philosophical take on magic or the nature of existence is kind of what it was getting at.
Okay, well, here's a clip that I think may illustrate a little bit of that. This is Luke and Yoda in the famous There Is No Try. Hang on.
We'll never get it out now.
So certain are you? Always with you, what cannot be done. Do you nothing that I say?
Master, moving stones around is one thing. This is totally different.
No. No different. Only different in your mind. You must unlearn what you have learned.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No. Why not? Do. Or do not. There is no try.
There is no try. That seems to be the lesson of Star Wars. Ethan, what do you think?
Well, for someone who grew up with not a lot of religious instruction or was not a church-going kid, I think like a lot of kids of the 70s and 80s who have parents maybe who had rejected those kinds of institutions as a way to find moral guidance or spiritual guidance, it makes perfect sense that a movie like Star Wars and its sequels would have such an impact on people. And I feel like, certainly in my household growing up, we certainly weren't quoting, Bible passages, but that line from Yoda, there is no try, do or do not. I mean, that was one of the things that we would just say, along with the oft quoted, phrase, may the force be with you. And I know that we didn't believe it, but it was just an interesting, different way of looking at the world to suggest that maybe there was something more to the world than just what we saw in front of us, that there was some force or some spiritual power that bound us together in a way. That seemed more plausible and more believable to me than I think stuff that I might have read in church or other things. I think that Mark Hamill in an interview said that he felt like the Force was, he called it religion's greatest hits, and I think that that's a pretty accurate summary of what Lucas was after there. It was a sort of non-denominational, quasi-religious idea that a lot of people could relate to, even people who were religious. They kind of got what it was about, even though, obviously no particular deity or particular, faith is invoked there. And it was a very smart idea, I think, to make it universal in that way.
We have full phones. Let's get some callers in here. We'll start in Madison with Nate. Nate, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hey, John. I guess I'm losing you too, but anyway, maybe you guys hear me. Great topic, first of all. I'm only 29 years old. I first saw Star Wars when both of my brothers, you know, kind of forced it down my throat, but I have very fond memories of sitting all day Saturday and Sunday weekend watching, you know, all three episodes. I guess the thing that kind of rung true for me was, you know, just the progressive nature of Lucas and his vision for the first, I guess, would be 4 through 6. You know, you have these underfunded, under-resourced rebels taking on the establishment. And then, you know, likewise, Lucas in the movie industry almost became the establishment when he did the second three, that would be 1 through 3. And, you know, you kind of, because of that, you know, he almost went too far with the visual effects and at the expense of, like, storyline and character and stuff like that. And it just was interesting to see kind of the role reversal. And who knows, like, if not fame, money, power, whatever that may be, how that affected Lucas, too. So, anyway, I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the question. Tony, you want to take this one on first, and then I want to get Ethan's thoughts on it as well.
Sure, yeah. You know, I really, I couldn't agree more. It's almost like he's the real-life filmmaking personification of Anakin Skywalker to a lot of people. You know, he starts off as this optimistic underdog, ready to, you know, take the world by storm and, you know, introduce this wonderful world to us. And then, yeah, later on, he sort of turns into his own Darth Vader by, you know, a lot of people felt betrayed by the new ones. I know I certainly was increasingly disenchanted with the newer episodes. And like the caller said, it got hung up on the things that were, the visuals were a big part of what made Star Wars so significant. But they weren't the only thing. And a lot of things, I think, were sacrificed for the sake of putting a lot of, you know, bright, cool images on movie screens. But that substance, those characters, those conflicts weren't necessarily there to back it up. And I know for me, I sort of viewed it as a slip to the dark side, so to speak, on George's part.
Ethan?
Well, I think I would like to comment on two parts of that. One is this idea that, as the caller said, this idea of a poorly funded group of people, you know, against all odds who defeat the evil empire. And we have to remember that Lucas was a child of the 60s. He came of age in the 1960s and early 70s, and that was certainly a time when these ideals were, you know, in the forefront. So I think in his own way, he was sort of saying, here's a way to use the ideas of the 60s and the counterculture in this very commercial film. And as to the other half of this, I mean, absolutely, I think that, unfortunately, a lot of Lucas's fans have, in a way, turned against him. I think the endless tinkering that he's done with a lot of his movies, where he's added scenes and added special effects to even the original movies, the original first three, you know, has struck a lot of people as just a really bad move. And I think that some of the goodwill that he's been able to generate over the years is chipped away a bit as a result of that. And also just the endless, there's a huge amount of, you know, obviously, as Tony said, it's a huge money-making endeavor, not just the movies, but all the merchandising.
Well, that was one of the things. That was one of the things that Star Wars seemed to really change. I mean, television programs had been marketing themselves with, there were lots of products associated with various cartoon characters. I'm old enough to have gotten a Man from U.N.C.L.E. A weapon set for Christmas one year. We won't reveal my age on the air, but it's pretty old. And so, you know, I mean, television had done this. Motion pictures up till that point hadn't done a lot of it, but all of a sudden with Star Wars, you had action figures, you had costumes, you had people selling lightsabers, you had all this licensed merchandise going out there and millions and millions of dollars coming in as a result of the sales. And so that was something that really changed. But I want to go back to something that I think both of you alluded to and our caller as well, the difference between the first three films, episodes 4 through 6, and the second ones. The impression that I got from looking at reviews and from watching the films myself was that the script writing in the first three films was much, much better. The characters got to actually act like human beings. And in the next three films, the characters were kind of made out of wood. They didn't, the scriptwriter wasn't the same. I think, I'm trying to remember her name, the woman who wrote the first three. She passed away, wasn't even available. But didn't Lucas write the scripts for the second trilogy?
He'd actually written the original, the first Star Wars. And, the woman you mentioned, Lee Brackett, passed away, and Lawrence Kasdan, who went on and wrote The Raiders of the Lost Ark. He wrote the screenplays for The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Lucas had more of a hand in Return of the Jedi. What's really hard to hear is George Lucas is very open about how he's a rather poor writer. He said it in interviews, and he's also mentioned that he's more comfortable with the effects and less so with the actors. Which, if you see interviews with Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, they constantly joke about how he would only give them one feedback. It was, I think it was faster, more intensity was all he would say if he had a problem with it at all, or he wouldn't say anything. So he's very open about his shortcomings as a filmmaker, yet he still takes the reins and controls everything. And we're seeing what's being sacrificed. The things he is good at, the spectacle, the big action set pieces in space, are still very fun, but all those characters, like you said, are very wooden. All this sort of boring, long-winded politicking going on. The execution was just really, it was very strange. If someone else had written it, I'm sure these episodes would have been much better. What's there isn't the problem. It's how it was executed, how it was directed, how it was written that really sort of, distanced them from the original trilogy.
I read one of the reviews of the re-edited, the so-called director's cut of the first three episodes. This was an illustration of why directors shouldn't be allowed to edit their own film. There was a really good reason why those extra pieces ended up on the cutting room floor. They didn't add anything, and they just made the film longer.
And I think that a lot of people who grew up watching those movies, like myself, we feel like these films had such a profound impact on us. Again, because we were relatively young, I think there's a magical age when you can watch these movies, and I think they just can really affect you quite profoundly. And so to have a filmmaker go back and change these scenes, something very simple, a street scene in Mos Eisley, like it looked this way, and now 20 years later, Lucas has gone and added all these goofy digital creatures and little whiz-bang things. It seems insulting. And again, he's the filmmaker. He's the creator of this universe. He very cleverly kept the rights and the intellectual property rights to everything. So he can do whatever he wants to it, of course, but there's a fine line, I think, between, exercising your free will and doing that as a creative person, and also respecting, I think, maybe the memory and the legacy of your audience, how the audience has carried this movie, kind of almost in their minds, over the decades.
Right, and his refusal to even meet in the middle and release both the original and the tinkered version. If Spielberg did that with E.T., he released both cuts. There's an interview in the New York Times earlier in the year when Red Tails came out, and he spoke about how Blade Runner had a DVD with five different versions, and he talked about it like it was a bad thing. But even, not even as a Star Wars fan, but as a fan of film, who wouldn't be interested in seeing the progression over the course of 35 years now, how one man's vision had changed, and especially the technology. He completely rewrote the book, and with the hard work of all these talented artists. And that's kind of a slap in the face, too, is all of their work being erased and replaced with new digital effects, which honestly just don't have that same warmth that it did 30 years ago.
Right. It's like the Soviet propagandists, just erasing, airbrushing things from the official record as if it never existed.
Yep.
Well, sometimes, though, this gets to sound like the argument between guitar players in the 80s, solid state versus tubes. And that's another cultural reference that probably went over everyone's head. Let's go back. Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we've got full phone lines, and we'll just take calls for the rest of the hour. I'll get out of the way here and just try to steer the Starship and maybe bring it into a safe landing at about 11 o'clock. We're talking about Star Wars. It's the original film, 35 years old, last Friday. And we want to know, what was its impact on you? What did you think when you first saw the movies? And you probably have some other questions as well. We've got the guests who are experts on this universe and can answer your questions or at least comment intelligently on them. I'm John Munson. No one's going to suggest I'm going to comment intelligently on anything and get away with it. In for Kathleen Dunn, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I've got a bad feeling about this.
Oh, I have a bad feeling about this.
Very bad feeling about this.
I got a bad feeling about this.
I have a bad feeling about this.
I have a bad feeling about this.
I have a really bad feeling about this.
I have a bad feeling about this. We heard that enough. We even heard it in some of the Indiana Jones movies. It kind of almost became an insider catchphrase from Star Wars. I just had to play that montage because it was so much fun putting it together. Talking about Star Wars with a couple of guests today and with you, want to reintroduce the guests, and then we'll go right to the phones. Ethan Gilsdorf is author of Fantasy, Freaks, and Gaming Geeks, an epic quest for reality among role players, online gamers, and other dwellers of imaginary realms. And Tony Pacitti, author of My Best Friend is a Wookiee, One Boy's Journey to Find His Place in the Galaxy. Here's Pat and Wapan is next. Pat, go ahead.
Hi. I just had two questions, one of which was... you know, I had always loved the world building of Star Wars, except for one thing that always drove me crazy, and that is the single biome world. Every world, you got Kashyyyk is a forest world, you got Tatooine, the desert world, you got Hoth, the ice world. And, you know, there's no real depth to each one of the planets, yet as a whole, the whole galaxy does have some depth. And then my other question was, earlier you guys were talking about the Force and how, you know, in the original trilogy, it was really more of a, you know, mystical, well, Force. And in the second trilogy, it was explained, perhaps to some detriment, as midichlorians. So I wonder what you guys think about the, you know, removing of the mysticality of the Force from the Force. Thank you.
Ethan, why don't you go first on this one, and then we'll get Tony's opinion.
Yeah, well, I probably am better on the first one, first question than the second, although I'm not a scientist or a geologist or a paleontologist or any of these. Just, of course, yeah, I mean, I think that's, to a certain extent, as you were talking about earlier, the sort of willful suspension of disbelief that you have to... you know, let the creator of these universes kind of, you know, take a stab at creating these worlds and whether or not they really hold up. Lots of people complained about, you know, should spaceships really explode in space? Would they make a noise? You know, all these kinds of things. Would there even be oxygen? So there could be an explosion. But I think what's actually quite clever about what Lucas has done is, of course, much more of the world exists outside of what you see in the movies. And if you're a father or an uncle, you know that there's Legos and there's books and there's all this other stuff, tie-in novels and so forth, that continues the story and characters of further fleshes out many of these worlds, gives them backstories and gives them, you know, depth and I guess you could say legitimizes their existence, which, you know, like someone like Tolkien, who did that with Lord of the Rings as well, you know, very, very smartly left areas of his world not quite entirely painted in, and let some of his minions or fans fill in the spaces. So anyway, that's sort of my thoughts on the first part. I don't know, Tony, if you have any thoughts on the changing of the Force over the course of the two sets of movies.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. But to answer about the planets real quick, I always like to think that Alderaan was a pretty... you know, diverse planet as far as climates and types of geography was concerned, but then the Empire blew it up. So I think right. that was the one diverse planet in the movie series was destroyed in the first one. But yeah, about the midichlorians and the Force, that was huge, and that's a big bone of contention for a lot of fans. Is the Force was this wonderfully ambiguous mysticism, like Ethan said earlier, non-denominational. They never pinpoint it. They call it, the Force couldn't be any more of a vague name for this thing. But by nailing it down to a science, that it's actually these microorganisms living symbiotically in the character's blood, it was very, it just really spoke to where the new movies were going. A lot of that magic was gone. And yeah, it just sort of sterilized a lot of things. And you notice that they never mention it again after episode one. That and Jar Jar Binks sort of got brushed to the sideline.
And good.
I don't know if maybe they just hoped people would forget about them.
Yeah, no harm done there. Just get rid of that character.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be the majority opinion. Let's see. Let's go. Well, let's talk to Brian in Edgerton next.
Hello.
Brian, good morning.
I just got done sitting on the floor playing with my old Star Wars toys with my son while you were talking here. So, it's been pretty appropriate conversation. I wanted to talk a little bit about around 91, Timothy Zahn wrote his Heir to the Empire series, and that really brought Star Wars back. You know, I was a huge Star Wars fan growing up. Anyone who knows me knows that. And it really kind of reawakened Star Wars in popular culture. And sometimes I think we give Lucas a little too much credit. You know, there's a lot of people who went into making both the original movies and the expanded universe, like you guys were just talking about. And I wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Yeah, go ahead. Tony, you want to talk first? Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I remember, and I talk about it in my book, that time my dad takes me to a bookstore, and I expect him, he's going to walk out with an armful of Tom Clancy books or something, and he has Heir to the Empire and Dark Force Rising, and tells me their story is set after Return of the Jedi, and this was before the idea of the prequels ever happening was, that was before that was even a real possibility, and you're looking in the back, and there's more stories that take place after the events of the movies. And they were great, and they showed us where these characters might have gone if the series kept going. And that's another thing, that with all of this tinkering and, retconning, as they say in comic books, George Lucas isn't just erasing special effects that were, that had been established for 30 years with new ones. He's changing storylines and characters that other people put their all into to create and add to this big sandbox that he made. And that's sort of upsetting, too, is, episode 3 comes out and suddenly a whole bunch of comic books and novels that you read when you were a kid don't mean anything anymore within the context of these films because he's changed the course of history, essentially. There's a whole, branching degree of canon with these films and books. Anything out of George's mouth goes, and then after that is varying degrees of alternate timelines and that sort of thing. And it's just kind of, it's kind of a slap in the face to people who have also thrown their two cents into creating something in this world.
And Ethan, go ahead.
Well, I have not too much to add there, only this idea that I think, just the idea of maintaining this universe is just such a huge, task, and it's obviously not possible for one person to do it. And I guess you have to give Lucas credit for letting other people, build stories and write other stories and write novels and so forth. The irony is that it seems like, for those people who are not very happy with the second trilogy, the prequels, that he didn't do a very good job of getting outside input. I don't know if people were concerned that he didn't how they would react if they criticized what he was saying, or maybe he didn't show people the scripts. But as you're saying earlier, Tony, he's known not to be the greatest writer, and it seems like ironically that was for the movies, that's where he could have really used some good help, because there are obviously a lot of better ideas out there.
Well, you know, it reminded me of the way I reacted to the Star Trek reboot. Here you had, they'd had a Bible, Paramount had had a Bible that authors who were writing Star Trek fiction had to work within. This is what the universe looks like for this series, and this is what has happened, and these are the relationships, and all of a sudden, oh, you know what, we're just going to toss all of that and start over again and make up a bunch of new stuff. And I know a lot of people really loved it. I found it somewhat off-putting because, hey, they're messing with a universe that that has been kind of stable for a long time. And that sounds like the same reaction you were having to some of the changes that were made when the prequels came out. We're starting to run a little short of time. I want to get to Anton in Madison next. Anton, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. It's a great show, but it got me thinking as to why I myself never got into the Star Wars mania. And I'm wondering if it's because I came from a different culture and at a time when the initial Star Wars speak had already gone through in the early 90s. It wasn't really a big deal anymore in the popular culture until the reboot, you know, until the second series came out. And I came from the Soviet Union, which in many ways could have been the evil empire in the Star Wars, you know, symbology. But I never really looked at the whole scenery as something that interesting. I really got into Star Trek, and I'm wondering if it's because the, you know, a lot of the Star Wars imagery is very much like the Soviet Union was, you know, broken down, kind of. You know, strange relationships and then things that were just not as clean as the ideological, you know, the kind of escape from reality that we were looking at coming from that environment to begin with. And, you know, the Star Trek series offered an escape, whereas Star Wars was more like, well, you know, here's more of the same struggle of evil versus good, and it's all happening under, you know, these kind of strange, broken-down circumstances and machines. And so that's just my input, and I, again, a great discussion, and didn't want to be throwing any water on the fire here, but just my perspective.
Yeah, Tony, why don't you go first, and then Ethan, and we're getting short of time.
Sure, I mean, I can understand, you know, he always said he gravitated more towards Star Trek, which, you know, makes sense, you know, not to jump to any conclusions, but based on what he was saying, how it's broken down, you know, tough struggle against evil didn't really appeal to him, whereas Star Trek was this idea that in the future, like, you know, all you know, we've all sort of moved beyond a point where, you know, all that struggle was sort of happening. It was, you know, his Roddenberry's idea of a future utopia where the idea of going into space wasn't so much a competition or another kind of warfare, but more of exploration and enriching humanity as a singular entity as opposed to a world of fractured and divided nations. I you know, that's what I have.
Okay, Ethan, we've got a little over a minute.
Sure, yeah, just, I mean, obviously the movie opens with a line a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and people remember, need to remember that the Star Wars movies were set in the past, not the future, and of course all these worlds appeal to different people for different reasons, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, they don't work for some people. They do work for a lot of people. And that's kind of the beauty of where we're at now in the evolution of geek culture. Is there's many, many worlds to choose from that can push all of our buttons and make us all feel like, you know, anything is possible.
We just have a few seconds, but it just seems to me that this is that Star Wars has kind of been passed from one generation to the next, and we have there's a lot of interest even from people who weren't born until quite a ways after the first films were made. What accounts for the longevity that we saw? And maybe each of you can give me about a 15-second response here. Tony, why don't you go first?
Like I said, it's just the magic of it and these characters that are so easy to relate to in such a fantastic world full of fantastic circumstances. It keeps me coming back, and I look forward to sharing those stories with my children or nieces and nephews as we go along.
Ethan, the last word for you.
Yeah, I would say the exact same thing. I would agree with Tony, and obviously, you know, there's new ways to make these movies relevant, and, of course, Lucas very cleverly keeps giving us new versions of the movies and new products to buy. So, of course, these are going to stay in the forefront of our minds.
Well, thanks to both of you for an enjoyable hour. We're going to let Alec Guinness have the last word here.
Use the Force, Luke.
He wants Luke to use the Force. Well, may the Force be with all of you. Thanks so much to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this fun hour. And thanks to my guests, Ethan Gilsdorf and Tony Pacitti, for also being my guests and for having such a wonderful conversation about this topic, which is fascinating to geeks everywhere. If you want to hear it all again, you can go to WPR.org, go to the Kathleen Dunn page, and you should be able to listen to the program if you missed some of it. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.